at the time of death, one of the things that makes death so frightening is that the self-grasping ignorance arises very strongly. There's an incredible fear that I will cease to exist. And on the basis of that, then we crave and grasp for aggregates. That makes previously karmically created seeds, karmic actions, ripen. And our mind is propelled by its own craving and grasping to seek another rebirth in yet another body that gets old and sick and dies. At the time of death, instead of grasping at inherent existence, instead of having so much attachment to the mental and physical aggregates, if we are able to focus the mind on the fact that there is no truly existent person dying, there are no truly existent aggregates there that are worthy of being attached to, if we can focus the mind on that at the time of death, then there's incredible peace. So in order to be able to do that at the time of death, we have to train the mind now while we're alive, while we're healthy. If we don't put energy into doing it now, how in the world will we be able to focus the mind on reality at the topsy-turvy time of death? So to be able to focus the mind in this way, we have to hear the teachings, think about them, meditate on them, familiarize our mind with them. And so that's what we're about to do right now. And we want to make sure that we do it for a very expansive reason. Not just out of self-concern, but with an altruistic intention that really cares about all beings. Knowing that if we can subdue our own mind and develop our own good qualities, we'll be able to be of the most excellent service to all others, as well as to fulfill our own spiritual aims. And so in this way we cultivate the bodhicitta motivation. So I thought today to go over what Rinpoche was talking about yesterday. I didn't do this specifically on the previous days because it seemed like those teachings were a little bit easier to understand, but he's getting into the good stuff now. And I should warn you, you know, or let you know that the first time you hear these teachings, there's a whole vocabulary that you have to learn. So it takes you a few times of hearing the teachings just to get the words down. Okay? And then it takes you a few more times of hearing them to understand the concepts, okay? And then it takes you more times of hearing them to really begin to get what the concepts are meaning on a deeper level and to apply it to your life. And so at the beginning it may sound like a lot of words and a lot of big vocabulary, and then you kind of, after a while, you get the concepts and it sounds like, oh, all this nice conceptual stuff, but how in the world does it relate to my life? That was the question that Venerable Parva was asking yesterday, you know, kind of, okay, but what does this have to do with my experience? And so then it's after that that you really start looking at your own experience and see that what he's talking about is describing our own experience. Okay? At first it just seems like this bunch of stuff, like, what in the world? Yeah? But he's actually talking about what we're doing day in and day out.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we are so familiar with the appearance of true existence. We are so familiar with the grasping at true existence that we don't even recognize it. Mm-hmm. You know? So even when we hear it described, we don't even recognize that that's what he's talking about, because we're so familiar with it, and we just take that so much for granted as that is what is. Yeah, it just never, we can't see how it has anything to do with us, you know? Okay, but in actual fact, if we take some time and look at our own experience, we'll see that that's exactly what he's talking about. But it really takes some time to do it. Okay, put it this way. Every time we are upset, the mind is grasping at a true existence. Okay? All those times when you are unhappy and upset and resentful and irritated and aggravated and fed up and you want it to change, you're grasping at true existence. That's it. Okay? But do we think at that time that we're grasping at true existence? No. All we think about is, I can't stand this. It needs to change. And we're so caught up in the vision of what we're experiencing that we have no idea our mind is totally under the influence of delusion. You know, totally under the influence of delusion. And we don't see it. Huh? Every time, put it another way, every time when our mind is sitting there going, I want this, I want that, this is so beautiful, I want it. Oh, I want to be near this person. They're so wonderful. You know, whenever the mind is having that going on, you're grasping at true existence. That's it, right then and there. Okay? But again, we don't see that as, you know, a faulty mental state at all. We see it as that object is really that wonderful and we desperately need it in order to be happy. And that's reality. Okay? So do you see how totally deluded we are? That we don't even realize we're deluded? You know? I mean, it's one thing if you understand your mind is, you know, crazy. But if you don't understand your mind's crazy and you think your mind is the, you know, the most realistic thing that turned around, then we're really out of it, you know? So this is the state we're in. Okay. And it's really rather shocking to kind of realize this and acknowledge it, you know. And then we begin to get a feeling about how much compassion the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas must have to hang in there with us, okay. And how much compassion we have to develop for other sentient beings to hang in there with them when their minds are so obscured by ignorance just like ours is. Okay, so with that as an introduction, let's go review what he was talking about yesterday, okay? It's funny, you know, we hear this, self-grasping this, self-grasping that, it's the root of samsara, all sentient beings are suffering from it. But not me, you know, I perceive reality. Okay, once in a while I'm a little bit unhappy, but that has nothing to do with my mind, it has to do with the situation. Okay, so let's just start with verse 25, that's where you started yesterday. Okay, so the doctrines of definite goodness are said by the conqueror to be deep, subtle, and frightening to the childish who are not learned. I am not, I will not be, Venerable C said it's better to say, I do not exist, I will not exist. Mine does not exist, mine will not exist. That frightens the childish and extinguishes fear in the wise. Okay, so the doctrines of definite goodness, he's saying that definite goodness here refers to emptiness. Usually definite goodness refers to liberation and enlightenment, but emptiness is what we realize to attain those. Okay, the conquerors refer to the Buddha. Okay, so emptiness, deep, subtle, that's okay. Frightening? We don't want to be frightened. Well, but it's frightening to the childish, but who aren't learned, but we're not childish ones. Yeah. So, okay, the little kids, you know, they get scared by it, but not us. Okay. So, what is it that the childish, in other words, us, yeah, us ordinary beings who haven't realized emptiness directly, find, or actually who don't have, I would think that probably the people on Path and Seeing wouldn't be called childish. They haven't realized emptiness directly. They've realized it conceptually with a valid inference, but I don't know if you would call them childish or not. Have to check on that. Okay? We confuse. This is where he started talking about the aspect self and the reference self. We confuse those two. Okay? The aspect self is the truly existent one. Truly existent, the way I'm using it here, inherently existent, what Rinpoche was saying, existing from its own side, yeah, existing by way of its own characteristics, all these things are synonymous, okay? According to Prasangika, not according to all the schools. But the aspect self is that truly existent one, okay? That has never existed, but that appears to us to exist, and that we grasp at as existing in the way it appears. Okay, there's the appearance, that's the cognitive obscuration. Then we assent to that appearance, we agree with it, we grasp at it as true, as real, and that is the afflictive obscuration. Okay, one part of the afflictive obscuration. Okay, so that's the aspect self. The reference self is the conventionally existent I, which is the mere I. Okay? That's the mere I that exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon the four or the five aggregates. I think when Kensa Rinpoche was mentioning the other day the continuity of the mental consciousness, which is the illustration of the person, that could be one of the bases of designation of the mere I. When you talk about what is the mere I that carries the karma, okay, that is what is labeled in dependence upon the continuity of the mental consciousness, which is the illustration of the person. So that is the conventionally existent I. That's the I that exists. Okay, the mere I, the one that is unfindable when you search for it. Okay. The aspect I is the one that we firmly believe exists, but when we analyze, when we search for it using ultimate analysis and try and find out exactly what the word I refers to, we look for the I within the basis of designation, in other words, within the aggregates, the mental and physical aggregates, okay, that's the one that we're looking for, is the inherently existent one, okay? That's the one, it's never existed, but we're totally 110% convinced it exists, okay? So we're looking for what we are sure exists, okay? We're childish beings, so we can't distinguish that one which doesn't exist from the conventional I, the reference self, which does exist. We have the two completely conflated. And so that's why when the childish can't find the truly existent self, because they haven't distinguished it from conventionally existent one, then they get scared because they think that not finding the truly existent one means the conventionally existent one doesn't exist either. Okay? And so that's why it causes that fear. It's like at the time of death, what I was saying in the motivation. There's this incredible grasping at I. Yeah? In fact, the object of that eye grasping at the time of death is totally non-existent. Okay? That eye that we're like going, you know, I'm separating from everything I know. I'm separating from everything I am. I'm separating from everything, and I'm going to become non-existent. Okay, that one doesn't exist anywhere, but we're totally convinced it does, and we're holding on to it. Yeah, and we don't distinguish it from the conventionally existent one. If we could realize that one didn't exist, we could just relax. You know, conventionally existent I just takes care of itself. Okay? But we hold on to things simply because they're familiar. Yeah, even if they're hard. I told a story at one retreat. People really liked it, so I'll tell you this story too. When I was a little kid, we had a swimming pool in our backyard. And before they put a fence around it, my little brother was on his tricycle riding around the swimming pool, and he rode his tricycle. He was about 3 years old, maybe, you know, really little. He rode his tricycle off into the deep end, and the tricycle went to the bottom of the swimming pool, and he held on. You know, this is self-grasping. It's an analogy to self-grasping. We hold on to what is familiar. And his tricycle was familiar. And he held on to his tricycle, even though it was at the bottom of the swimming pool. So we hold on to that truly existent I, even if it causes us to revolve in cyclic existence for infinite time. We hold on. Now, very fortunately, there was the guy who cleans the swimming pool, who was also a family friend. He was nearby, and he dove in with his clothes on and pried my brother off of his tricycle, you know, because Russ was still holding on to that tricycle. He had to pry him off and carry him up. So that's what the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are trying to do with us. We are holding on to the wrong conception of self with all our might, and they are trying to pry us away as we continue to grasp. Okay? I don't know if my brother remembers that. I should ask him sometime. Anyway. Okay. So, you know, we can't differentiate, you know, what exists and what doesn't exist, what's good for us and what isn't good for us. Yeah. So that's how we get into a lot of trouble. So in verse 26, when it says, I don't exist, I will not exist, mine doesn't exist, mine won't exist, it's referring there to the referent self, I'm sorry, to the aspect self, to the truly existent one. Okay? And because that is the one that the childish beings have mixed up with the conventionally existent one. Okay? When the wise see that the truly existent self doesn't exist and has never existed, that extinguishes their fear. In the childish, it makes them have fear. Okay? Why does it extinguish the fear in the wise ones? First, because they can differentiate between the truly existent one, which is non-existent, and the conventionally existent one, which does exist. Okay. Second reason they it extinguishes their fear is because they realize that grasping at the truly existent one is the source of all of their misery, and has been the source of all of their misery since beginningless time. And if they don't get rid of it, it'll continue to be the source of their misery. So by seeing that the truly existent one doesn't exist, then that grasping at the true existence gets extinguished. And therefore, their fear of cyclic existence, their fear of the real enemies of ignorance, is extinguished. So I think that depends upon doing a lot of meditation. First of all, seeing the disadvantages of cyclic existence, and tracing its root to the self-grasping, and really identifying that self-grasping as the real enemy. Okay, so the real enemy isn't Saddam Hussein, it's not Osama bin Laden, it's not George Bush. We got to give the guy a break. Okay, that's not the real enemy. The real enemy is that self-grasp. So every time we are upset and angry, what we should do and point to as the enemy is our self-grasping, is our own anger, not to the other person who did or said whatever. Okay? But we usually don't think about that at the time. And that's why when I told you the story about Venerable Steve and I from 20 years ago, you know, why at the end of it he said, oh, I think we failed to see the object of negation, you know, because when we were in the middle of it, we didn't, you know, we were just there in the middle of it. Okay? Verse 27. By him who speaks only to help beings, in other words, the Buddha, it was said that all beings have arisen from the conception of I and are enveloped with the conception of mine. The I exists, the mine exists. These are wrong as ultimates, for the two are not established by a thorough consciousness of reality just as it is. Okay? So all beings have arisen from the conception of I and are enveloped by the conception of mind. So let's just take a minute and talk about what's this I and mine, okay? The I is, yeah, the I, the agent of the actions. The mine is one nature with the I. It's not separate, but it's the I that is the owner, okay? Sometimes we say mine, sometimes you could say my. Okay, so it's the I that is the owner. Now sometimes when it's described, mine is, you know, my body, my mind, my friends, my security, my 401k, my this, my that, okay, my marriage, my divorce, my chocolate cake, you know, whatever it is. And so it's easy for us to be able to think at that moment that mine refers to those external things that we're grasping at. No. Mine is part of the self-grasping at persons. So it's the person that is the owner. We're grasping at the I as it is appearing as the one who is the owner. The my who owns the thing. Okay? And so that's why I find it very interesting, you know, when the mine or the my gets activated, to really ask myself, you know, who is this thing, this one that owns things, and what is it that makes something mine? Because when I have a lot of grasping at mine, I feel that, you know, inside this clock, this is my clock. My clock. It's not yours. Don't you touch your, put your dirty little hands on it, you know. Okay. This is mine. I mean, they always have these innocuous objects on our, you know, on our table. You know, one day something, maybe there should be $1,000 bill. Then people would get excited about it. You know, the example, nobody gets excited about the clock, you know. But $1,000 bill. Okay, this is $1,000 bill, okay? My $1,000, I don't even know if there's $1,000 bills, but let's, okay, yeah, you know, my money, mine, don't touch it, it's mine, okay? Who is that mine that owns it? We feel like there's something inside that object that is mine, yeah, don't we? There's some mind, there's something in it that makes it mine. Yeah. In actual fact, it's only called mine because we give it that label. Yeah. And you know what a lot of court cases are about? It's about the definition of mine. And a lot of wars are about the definition of mine. I remember so clearly teaching in Israel, being in the, having a retreat in the middle of the Negev desert. And the kibbutz was right on the border with Jordan. Okay? Jordan's a friendly country, but you never know. you know, but the kibbutz is right on. So, you know, it takes, it took like about, I don't know, 1 minute to walk from the meditation hall to the border. So there's this big fence, okay, and it, this is the desert, remember? So it's all sand. So there's this big fence in the middle of the sand, and then for about, I don't know, 10 feet or 15 feet on the other side of the fence, there is raked sand, okay? So that if anybody tries to cross it, they leave their footprints or some kind of print, you know? Okay. And then there's Jordan, okay? So I would stand there, and, you know, it's like, well, there's sand there, and there is sand there. I'm not terribly interested in, neither of the sand makes much sense to me, you know, much importance to me. But to some people, this sand is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And the demarcation line between which sand is yours and which sand is mine, we will fight and kill each other. Mm-hmm. We will fight and kill each other over the definition of what is mine. Yeah? Pretty scary. Yeah? And you look around the world, and so this is what so many wars are fought over. What is mine? Okay. And we feel like there's something mine in there. There's very strong feeling, you know, of this person who's the owner. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Sometimes when you're, you know, you see yourself grasping at mine and I want, ask yourself, what is it about that that's mine? You know, go take, mentally dissect whatever it is. And say, what is it that is mine? Like we could sit here and go, my Abby, our Abby, this is our Abby, it's not your Abby. You know, what is it about this that is ours? Yeah? There's a bunch of molecules put together in certain formations. That's all that's here. Yeah? That's all, folks. There's nothing ours in it. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, the one that we feel, you know, mine, ours. Yeah. So that's the mine. Okay. So all beings have arisen from this concept of I and this concept of mind. The Tibet, that we, together, those self-graspings of I and mine, it's called the view of the transitory collection. Okay. The Tibetan term is jitta. Jitta is much easier to say than wrong view of the transitory collection. Okay. But what this is, it's grasping at I and mine, and it's grasping at our own personal I and mine. Okay? So self-grasping of persons includes jitta, but it's not limited to jitta. Because I have jitta regarding my I and my mind, but grasping at you as self-existent and you as the owner of self-existent, when I do that, that's not jitta. When you do it, it's jitta, because you're grasping at yourself. When I do it, it's self-grasping at persons. Okay, because I'm grasping at persons. It doesn't matter you, me, whoever. But when it's referring to me in particular, that's the wrong view of the transitory collection, jitta. Okay? That jitta arises because of the self-grasping of phenomena. And here, phenomena refers to everything besides the person, but in particular, the aggregates, the mental and physical aggregates. So, first what happens is you have the appearance of the aggregates. Yeah, just the aggregates appear because our mind has the cognitive obscurations, the aggregates appear truly existent. We grasp at the aggregates as truly existent. Okay? because we grasp at the aggregates as truly existent, we also grasp at the I, which is merely labeled in dependence upon them, as truly existent. Okay, so there we have the self-grasping of phenomena, and then followed by the self-grasping of persons. And when it's related to us, it's the wrong view of the transitory collection. Okay, so first there's the appearance of the I, okay, then the grasping at the first there's the appearance of the aggregates as truly existent. There's the grasping at the aggregates as truly existent. And that gives rise to grasping at the I, which is merely labeled independence upon the aggregates, also as truly existent. The way Geshe explained it yesterday, he was saying, you know, based on the aggregates, then we merely label I, and that I appears to us as truly existent. And then very soon after that, we assent to that appearance and we grasp at it as truly existent. And here that's the innate grasping. Okay? So all this is the root of cyclic existence. So often we refer to, you know, what Jigta grasps at and what the self-grasping of persons and self-grasping of phenomena, they're all grasping at inherent existence. It's just the object that's inherently existent is slightly different. But their object, inherent existence, is the same. And so for that reason, they're all said to be the root of samsara. But we often really single out the jitta, the self-grasping at I and mind, because that's the one that most frequently comes up. And that's the one that causes us the most problems. Okay? When you get insulted, I don't get upset. Okay? I may be perceiving you as, you know, you may be appearing truly existent to me. Yeah? And even a little bit, I may grasp you at that. But, you know, when you get insulted, I don't get bummed out. Yeah? Because I don't have so much grasping at the inherent existence of you. It doesn't come up as strongly for me or as frequently for me. But if I get insulted, the grasping at true existence is like, you know, it occupies the entire universe. And that's why somebody insulting me is, you know, the worst thing that happened in the planet the entire day. Yeah. And that's why we go around, you know, our lives feeling like, you know, everything that happens to me is the most important thing. Okay, so the inherent existence in all these ones that we're grasping at is the same. But because we're the one that is grasping at our own conventional self is inherently existent, it's mistaking it as inherently existent. That's the one that's more trouble for us than anyone else. And so that's why sometimes, for example, in this verse, when it's talking about the conception of I and the conception of mind and saying how beings are born from that, it's emphasizing that. But it doesn't mean that the others aren't involved. They are. Okay. So we have, and jitta, you know, it's the English translation, wrong view of the transitory collection. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes it's translated as wrong view of the perishing aggregates. Okay, it means the same thing. Okay, transitory and perishing, just different translations. Mm-hmm. And aggregates and collection mean, you know, same idea. The collection or the aggregates refer to our own personal, mental, and physical aggregates. Yeah, and the fact that they are perishing. Moment by moment, they don't exist a second moment. Remember, they're arising, abiding, and perishing simultaneous. So they're perishing, they're transitory. Yeah. So on the basis of these, we impute I, and then we grasp that I as truly existent. Okay? So that's why it's called the wrong view of those transitory collections. But you can see there's a few steps in there. Let me jump ahead a little. Well, maybe I better not. Okay. How does all of this cause samsara? It's because on the basis of grasping an inherently existent me and mine, okay, then I get attached to what seems to please the eye. I freak out at anything that obstructs the happiness of the eye. You know, I get arrogant because I think I'm better than everybody else. I get jealous because I think they're better than me. I get competitive because I'm vying with them to, you know, to see who's the alpha Dharma practitioner. So then all this rubbish, you know, I try and conceal my own faults. I try and pretend I have qualities I don't have. I'm reckless in how I keep my precepts. You know, I don't care if I even keep them. I'm unconscientious. You know, so all these other defilements arise. Motivated by these, you know, mental defilements, these mental afflictions, we act. Okay, we do those 16 actions that, you know, plus all the other ones that Nagarjuna didn't mention. You know, aren't you glad he only mentioned 16? Yeah, I mean, there's an infinite number of more. He gave us a bargain budget. But we do all of those, and that's negative karma, which leads the seeds on the continuum of our mind, on the mere eye, okay? And then it ripens into what we experience, and, you know, it ripens into throwing us into another life, yeah, with another body, another rerun, okay? Yeah, rerun, slightly different self-concept, slightly different environment, but again, just rerun, isn't it? Samsara is the oldies and baddies. It's just rerun after rerun, you know, trying to eke out some pleasure somewhere. Yeah, but you know, without the Dharma practice, kind of the end of the story is basically known, you know? It's just going to produce another rebirth. Okay, that's what, you know, Dharma practice is so important. Okay, so that's how, you know, having arisen, all beings having arisen from the, have arisen from the conception of I and are enveloped with the conception of mind. Okay, so that's why it's said to be the root of cyclic existence. Okay, so the I exists, the mind exists, these are wrong as ultimate. Okay, so when we are analyzing and investigating to try and find the truly existent I and the truly existent mind, when we use ultimate analysis, which means we're searching within the basis of designation, the body and mind, to try and find what it is, we can't find anything. Okay. Now, Kensa Rinpoche made a very strong point at the beginning yesterday, and he said, just not finding the I in the when you search in the aggregates doesn't mean you've realized emptiness. Okay? Do you notice he said that? You know, because lots of times we ourselves, we sit down and we do the four-point analysis. You know, oh yeah, okay, yeah, I'm looking for the truly existent I. I'm not my body, yeah, okay. I'm not my mind, yeah, okay, I can accept that. I'm not something different. Yeah, that's easy. What's for lunch? You know, I've realized emptiness. Why is realizing emptiness so important? It's like, you know, it's not so hard. Well, that's because we haven't gotten it yet. We haven't been searching. There's two things we haven't done. First, we haven't been searching for the truly existent I. And second, we haven't decisively concluded that if that I is not findable in the aggregate and not findable outside of the aggregate, then it doesn't exist. So these are actually the first two points in the four-point analysis. Mm-hmm. And I was telling you the other day that when I was studying Madhyamaka with Geshe Sonam Rinchen, and we would always, you know, ask him this question and that question, and his usual answer was, you haven't understood yet the object to be negated, the object of negation. He kept on saying, oh yeah, Kenma, you said that before, but, you know, you also said this that we don't agree with, you know. And why don't we agree with it? Because we couldn't differentiate the object, we couldn't see what the object of negation was, and we were conflating it with the conventionally existent I. Okay. And this is just our experience, our daily life experience. So it's not even, first we have to intellectually be able to separate them. But then, even in our daily life experience, it's so hard to separate. Remember the other day when I was talking about three ways of apprehending the I? As truly existent, as non-truly existent, second one being what the Aryas do, and the third one is neither. Mm-hmm. So the closest we ever get in our regular perception is the neither, you know? But we're not capable of differentiating the object of negation and the conventionally existent one completely. You can't do that until after you've realized emptiness. Mm-hmm. It's only after you've realized emptiness that you can really see the conventionally existent I is only existing nominally. Yeah, because our mind is just, you know, completely puts them together. Anyway, so, you know, we have to try as much as we can to at least get some idea of what is this truly existent one that we're looking for in the analysis. Yeah, and like I said, that's the one, yeah, when we're angry. When we're angry, when we're upset, okay, when you're fed up, yeah. I've been working so hard and they're asking me to do more. I'm fed up. Everybody at the lab is laughing. I wonder why. We asked to do more. Why? You know? I want to rest. Okay, that I, okay, that's the truly existent one. Yeah, that's the one. I can't stand this. You know, like I told you, when I was in escrow buying this place and I was having to go and lead a retreat and walk into the meditation room all calm and collected, and then in the break time I was on the phone with the lawyer, on the phone with the realtor, on the phone trying to get a radon system, faxing this, talking to that, trying to get some insurance because the escrow is closing in a few days and we don't have it all together, and then the bell rings and I have to go smoothly and lead this Dharma course, you know. Yeah. And so at one point I'm going, I can't do this anymore. You know? And then this idea popped in my mind, well, you've been doing it so far. What do you mean you can't do it anymore? You've been doing it so far. So then I settled down. Okay? But anyway, so that mind, you know, that mind, I can't stand this. Yeah? Or the mind, somebody makes fun of you. Somebody teases you. Yeah? And they make fun of you. Or somebody, this happens a lot at the Abbey too, somebody tells you how to do something that you already know how to do. Yeah? What do you think I am? A total imbecile? You're telling me how to thread this needle? You know. But then on the other hand, when they don't tell us how to do things that we don't know how to do but expect us to know how to do, then we equally get angry, don't we? Why didn't you give me proper instructions? Do you think I'm a genius and I'm going to figure this out myself? In other words, we're expecting them all to be able to read our mind, aren't we? They should be able to read our mind. They should know what I don't know how to do and give me exactly the instructions up to the point where I know that already. And they should already know that because they should have clairvoyance. And they should not have to tell me to do what I already know how to do. And they should know the difference between them. Forget the part that I can't even know the difference in myself between them. And I get confused over how to do something all the time. That doesn't matter. They're supposed to read my mind and know. Okay. Should we get mad? They tell us how to do something we know how to do, and we get mad if they don't tell us how to do something we don't know how to do. Okay. That I that's getting mad, that's the truly existent one. Okay. That I shouldn't say that I that's getting mad. That I that is appearing to the mind at that point, that's the truly existent one. Okay. Do we ever think at that point that that's the object of negation? Do we ever stop and say, who is that? What is that? Does that exist? No. Okay. But that's it. That's it. Okay. Whenever you're sitting in the meditation hall and your knees hurt and your back hurts and your head hurts and your stomach hurts and you're going, I can't stand this. I ache all over this body. It's too much. You know, I want a new body already, but I don't want to get reborn. And I don't want to have to sit here anymore and generate merit and wisdom to not have a new body. I just hate this body and I hate being sick and I hate everything hurting. Okay, that you're grasping at the truly existent I at that point. Okay, that's the one that's appearing. We completely believe it exists, don't we? 100%. We never have any doubt. Okay. Similarly, we're grasping at the pain as truly existent. That's self-grasping at phenomena. This pain is truly existent pain. Yeah, it is because it's truly existent, it is a worthy object to get angry at, and I am angry. Okay. In other words, at that moment when you're sitting here, okay, in the meditation hall, surrounded by all the buddhas, you know, furious out of your mind, wanting to get up and run down that hill, that's the self-grasping mind. That's it. Okay? We laugh a lot about this during the winter retreat. Yeah. That's why we don't let people come with cars. So we have many, many good laughs about this. You know, because the winter retreat is the time you really see it at that time. It's so clear, you know. So, but that's exactly the time. You know, the I is truly existent. The pain is truly existent. Yeah. Everything I don't like is truly existent. The whole thing is concrete at that moment. Okay. So when that's happening, that's the moment that we have to say, my mind is totally under the influence of afflictions. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's the last thing we think of. And it's the last thing we want to admit. But that's the thing. My mind at this moment is under the influence of afflictions. Don't trust this mind. Don't trust it. Okay? And so at that point, that I that's appearing so strongly to exist at that point, that's the one you have to investigate to see if it exists. Okay? So you have to really take that very one. Because otherwise, you know, when we're sitting here all blissed out, everything, you know, for 2 seconds is the way we want it, it's hard to generate the self-grasping, you know. Of course, if you sit for more than 2 seconds, it very often comes. We'll get angry or attached or something. But look at what's the one there? Who's holding on to that? How does that one exist? And then you start to analyze, okay? So if you really identify correctly the object of negation, and then you have to say, if this exists, at this moment I am 102% convinced this exists. Yeah? If it exists, it's got to be findable. Because I feel it, man. You know, it's here. So if I'm going to find it, it has to be, you know, either in the body and mind or separate. There's no other place it could be. And you have to reach certainty about that too. Okay? It's not like, well, it could be in the body, it could be in the mind, but there's some other hideout place. No, you've got to see. It's either got to be there or there. You know? So they talk about it. They always use the example of a cow. But that example doesn't do it, you know, because we aren't so interested in what happened to our cow. Your wallet with your credit card and your ID and your recently cashed paycheck, okay, and all the pictures of your loved ones, and maybe a few money pills, okay? Your wallet, you know, it's either in this room or it's in that room. and you've decided it's either here or it's there. There's no other third alternative. Okay? It's either here or it's there. There's no other third alternative because I didn't go anywhere besides here and there. Okay? So then you search here, then you search there. If you don't find it in either place, then the only possible conclusion you can draw is it doesn't exist. Gone. You know, they took it to the Pure Land. Okay? Something like that. It vanished. Okay? So it's the same thing. It's got to be either in the aggregates or separate from them. No third alternative. When you have those, then you want to hold that truly existent one kind of strong in your mind. And at the same time you're holding it strong in your mind with another part of your mind, start poking around. And is this the body? Is this the mind? Is it separate from the body and mind? Okay. And you start to see how sometimes you identify it with the body and then you say, well, if it's the body, then there's these faults. If it's the mind, then there's these faults. If it's separate from them, then there's those faults. Okay? So you start to search and analyze. Yeah. When you don't find it at the end of your analysis, that is a valid cognizer that's realized emptiness. And Rinpoche was saying, at that time, you know, when you've seen that what you thought existed, this realization, it's got to be so shocking because our whole life is based on this concept of me, you know? I mean, we just look, if you look at your life, everything is based on this concept of me. Everything. All the time, just me, I, mine, all the time, okay? So it's got to be, you know, when you see that that isn't there and you've based everything on it, that's got to be a real whammo realization, yeah? So you're so much like, whoa, you know, it doesn't exist. So remember we're talking emptiness is a negation, it's a lack, it's an absence, it's an unfindability, that's nothing positive. So it's a like, wow, that doesn't exist, yeah? When you realize emptiness directly like that, at the same, you know, because you've realized the truly existent one doesn't exist, at that time the truly existent one stops appearing to your mind. Because you've realized it doesn't exist. So it no longer appears. So at that moment, when you're in meditative equipoise on emptiness, there's no appearance of true existence. You know, all the rest of our consciousnesses, sentient beings' consciousnesses, there's the appearance of true existence. But in that meditative equipoise that directly sees emptiness, there's no appearance of the true existence. Okay. By the way, the conventional I also doesn't appear at that time, nor do the conventional aggregates, nor do any other conventional things. Yeah, none of them appear at that time. That doesn't mean that they don't exist. And here's where Rinpoche gave the example of our visual consciousness. You know, our visual consciousness, the eye consciousness, it sees colors and shapes. Can the visual consciousness see smells?
No.
No matter how much it tries, smells are not in the purview of the visual consciousness. It's incapable of perceiving smells. So although smells don't appear to the visual consciousness, and the visual consciousness does not apprehend smells, it cannot apprehend the absence of smells. Okay, you with me? The visual consciousness can't apprehend that perfume. Oh, perfume stinks. How about something nice? Sandalwood incense. Okay? I think most of the perfume they make is terrible. Sandalwood incense. Okay, the eye consciousness cannot apprehend the smell of the sandalwood. Okay? To that mind, the sandalwood does not exist. But that mind has not apprehended the non-existence of the scent of the sandalwood. Why? Because it's incapable of apprehending either the existence or the non-existence of the smell of the sandalwood, mm-hmm. because it's not in its purview. It's not what it's capable of perceiving. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the mind that directly realizes emptiness, yeah, is incapable of ascertaining either the existence or non-existence of any conventional phenomena. No conventional phenomena appear to that mind. But that doesn't mean the conventional phenomena don't exist, because that consciousness does not see the non-existence of those phenomena. Okay? So when you're meditating on emptiness, you know, there's the truly existent I. You negate that one. You're seeing emptiness at that time. Emptiness which is like space. It's called space-like emptiness. Yeah. There's no appearance of a truly existent anything. And there's no appearance even of the conventionally existent one. And there's no grasping in the mind at that time. Yeah. That mind, as you know, realizes, perceives only emptiness, nothing else. Only the emptiness of true existence. That's all it perceives. And is completely, you know, one-pointed on that. Yeah. When you come out of that meditative equipoise, yeah, then you have a conventional consciousnesses, yeah, our eye consciousness, ears, our five sense consciousnesses, we have our mental consciousness, our conventional mental consciousness, okay, all these things perceive conventional objects, and they can establish the existence or non-existence of the conventional objects. Yeah, the mind realizing emptiness, you know, it establishes the non-existence of the truly existent things. Okay, it realizes, it perceives that non-existent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that mind that realizes emptiness can't perceive or ascertain or establish any other phenomena or the existence of any other phenomena. Okay? It's only these conventional valid cognizers that come later when you're out of meditative emptiness that perceive all these different things and establish that there, yes, there's a conventionally existent I, and there's people and there's snow and everything else. Okay? These conventional valid cognizers that you have afterwards, they still have the appearance of true existence. Okay? Because remember, true existence appears until you're a Buddha. But they're valid cognizers. So you're going to say, well, wait a minute, if they're having this mistaken appearance of true existence, how can they be valid cognizers? They are valid in terms of being able to identify the conventional existent objects. This is a clock, this is a watch, this is $1,000 bill, this is, you know, chocolate chip cookies. It can identify that, yeah, and ascertain its conventional existence. But it's also a mistaken consciousness, because the appearing object to that consciousness is an inherently existent whatever. Okay? So although inherent existence appears to it, that's what makes it mistaken, because it doesn't really perceive the object as it is. Still, by the fact that on a conventional level, a nominal level, it's able to identify it correctly, it's called a conventional valid cognizer. Okay? So it's a conventional valid cognizer, even though it's mistaken. Okay. Another thing that Rinpoche got into speaking about yesterday was the two kinds of dogfin, okay, or grasping at the self. Yeah. And this is where Tibetan is so tricky, because this word zin, yeah, Zin, actually, it means to hold or to grasp, you know. You hold the cup, or you're grasping at this or that. Yeah, and you know, all these words we use for philosophy eventually have some kind of reference to just normal life, mm-hmm. Yeah? But, you know, so we say the mind is grasping. We're usually thinking of our hand as grasping or whatever. But it's that same idea, holding on to, yeah? The word Zen can be translated in a number of different ways, yeah? Another way of translating it is as apprehend. So when you say there's two kinds of self-grasping, one that's valid and one that's not valid, and then the self-grasping is the root of inherent existence, we can sometimes get very, very confused, like, wait a minute, there's this one, that one, and which one's valid, which one's not, which one do I want to get rid of, and, okay? So sometimes to clarify it, it's helpful to translate, even though the Tibetan word Zen appears in both, to translate one as apprehend and the other one as grasp. Okay, but Venerable Ski didn't do that, but I'm just pointing that out, that, you know. Okay, so you have the appearance of true existence, yeah, and then we... that appearance, we're apprehending things, we're still apprehending the objects, okay? Or Steve, you know, he said we're still grasping at it. So that would be the self-grasping, that's the okay one, you know? It knows the conventionally existent I. Oh, but it doesn't know it as conventionally existent. Okay, remind me about this and I'll explain that later. But this relates to something else we were talking about. Anyway, this is the okay kind of self-grasping. You know, I'm here, I'm sitting in the meditation hall. Yeah? Yeah. That's a correct way, it's a correct way of apprehending the I, even though there's the mistaken appearance of I to that consciousness. Okay? So that's one kind of self-grasping. Then the Dzogchen Lenke. Lenke means innate. Yeah? The innate self-grasping, that's the one that's been with us since beginningless time. And that's the one that says, not just I'm sitting in the meditation hall, but I am sitting in the meditation hall. Yeah? That, at that point, you know, when all of a sudden the I's gotten quite big and quite pronounced, that's, at that point, we're grasping at the truly existent I. Okay? Sometimes they talk about different objects of a consciousness. So in terms of this grasping at the truly existent I, we say that it's mistaken with respect to its apprehended object, or another way Jeffrey translates it as the object of the mode of apprehension. We'll talk about a lot of words, okay? But has Rinpoche used that expression, the mode of apprehension, yesterday? So the object of the mode of apprehension, or for short, the apprehended object, yeah, the self-grasping is mistaken with respect to that, because it's grasping, holding, apprehending a truly existent thing, which doesn't exist at all. The observed object of that mind is just the conventional I. It's not, you know, that's the observed object. But the object of the mode of apprehension is the truly existent one, and it's mistaken in terms of that. It's erroneous in terms of that. In terms of just the conventional, what he was saying, the eye grasping, that there's nothing wrong with it, which we could translate in English as just the apprehension of eye, just translating Zen as apprehension instead of grasping, that one is not erroneous with respect to its apprehended objects, or its object of the mode of apprehension, because it's not grasping it as truly existent. Okay? So that innate self-grasping, that's the one that you want to get rid of. But you can see how it's related to just the one, the self-grasping or the apprehension of self that isn't a problem, because it's on the basis of, you know, labeling I and the appearance of the conventional I, that then very quickly afterwards, when we get worked up, that we grasp that I is true existence. Okay? But we don't even notice the transition. Yeah? We don't even notice it. Yeah? Now, there's one thing to back up into. Our conventional valid cognizers, they apprehend the conventional objects, okay? That, you know, that I that, you know, the conventional I, the one that's exists, or the referent I, you know, if you want to call it that. Okay, it apprehends that, it apprehends all these other conventional objects. But our conventional valid cognizers right now are so covered with obscuration that they, although they apprehend the conventional objects, they don't apprehend them as conventional objects. Okay? Because you only apprehend them as conventional objects after you've realized emptiness. And then after you've realized emptiness directly, then you come back, you know, and you're able to see that things exist by being merely labeled. And at that point, you're able to ascertain these things as conventional existing objects. Okay? This relates to the discussion when we were talking about AIDS the other day, you know, 200 years ago, did AIDS exist? Well, you know, things only exist when they're labeled, don't they? Yeah, if you ask somebody 200 years ago, you know, is so-and-so sick with AIDS, they'd have no idea what you're talking about. So in one way, you know, it looks like AIDS doesn't exist. On the other hand, the virus was there, people were dying of it, so AIDS did exist. But it didn't exist, the label didn't exist, okay? So you get in a conundrum here, okay? What we could say is, and then remember I was saying from our viewpoint now, then we impute into the past, yeah? But we can say AIDS existed then, but it didn't exist as AIDS.
A label?
No. Yeah, well, because it wasn't labeled AIDS, it didn't exist as AIDS. But AIDS existed. Okay? It's kind of like if you're building a house and you haven't decided, you know, is this room a bedroom or is this room an office? Yeah? The time you're building the house, you wouldn't say this room is a bedroom, this room's an office, because you haven't made up your mind. When you've built the house and you come to, you know, move in the furniture, then, you know, you move a bed in one room and, you know, a desk in the other, and based on that you label this one bedroom and that one office, okay? At that time, you know, the bedroom and the office exist. But later on, afterwards, you know, after the house is all done, we've moved into the bedroom and the office, we might be talking to somebody and we might say, oh, when we were building the house, you should have seen the rubble we had in the middle of the bedroom.
Oh.
Yeah, we was just stacked high with the supplies and this and that, and it cracked and, you know, it was leaking and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so you can see at that time you impute backwards to that room, calling it a bedroom. Even though at that time if somebody had called it the bedroom, you would have said, no, don't call it the bedroom because I'm not sure. It might not be that. Yeah? Yeah, but from this viewpoint, you can look and say, okay, the bedroom existed, but it didn't exist as a bedroom. We hadn't given it that label at that time. So, a couple of questions. Yeah?
I have a question. Going back to the one question, when you were explaining how when you meditate on emptiness, well, when you try to meditate on emptiness and try to dissolve everything on emptiness, the mind cannot see the conventional eye, the existence of the conventional eye.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about when we meditate, like people are thinking that savanna or something, you dissolve everything in emptiness. You, let's say you have good concentration that day, you arrive to that point. Then, when you come out, do you do the meditation on the pending arising? Do you say, okay, but I do function in the world and I do exist in the world, then I come from cause and effect, and then I meditate on the pending arising just to counteract the fear of falling into non-existence?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so very good question. When you're doing a sadhana and you're doing the self-generation practice, you dissolve everything into emptiness. So at the end of that meditation, do you then start thinking, but I conventionally exist, and then you establish the whole set of dependent arisings in the visualization. Don't start out with the idea, I conventionally exist. Because hidden in there is some self-grasping. Okay? So don't start out with I conventionally exist. Okay. So just do the whole visualization, and you're trying to think that it's your wisdom realizing emptiness that is appearing in the form of the deity and the environment. Okay? And you go through the things that develop the image of the deity, and then you realize, oh, independence upon these pure aggregates, you can just lightly label I. Okay? And when you're trying to develop divine dignity or divine pride, it's in terms of this lightly labeled one. You don't want to let...
So you don't go all the way to the meditation in independent arising?
No, that is the meditation on dependent arising. Because
but
you
at
go...
At that moment, not because... I'm sorry to interrupt. So that you say that you label I is during the meditation in the self-generation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do it, you as a person.
No, your old self is gone.
Gone, okay.
Gone, finished. Okay, this body, the appearance of this body is gone. So you're labeling I in dependence upon the deity's body and the deity's mind, which you are imagining having. Okay, so in dependence upon those pure aggregates, then you say, oh, you know, we went through this whole cause and effect in the visualization. That's how deity is produced by cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is it produced by, you know, depending on name and concept, because you just lightly, you say, oh, this could be called I.
But to be very clear, I'm sorry. So you don't go back to say, okay, this self-generated image is something lightly labeled I. But you don't want to say, and this one comes because I can form it, and not myself, but it is formed out of emptiness because everything can change and it makes me
yeah,
this
you,
and that.
You know, I
was that, but now I can be these.
Yeah.
Well, not the act.
Mm-hmm. You see, this all everywhere, the self-grasping sneaks in here. You know, you go through the evolutionary process of becoming the deity. And at the end you realize that's a suitable basis to label I. Then when you're saying the mantra, you can see that the I, you know, I exist, but it's empty. How does it exist? It's dependent. What's it dependent on? Then you can, you know, review how it's caused. Okay. So you go back and forth between, oh, it appears, but it's empty. It's empty, but it appears. Actually, you do that before you say the mantra.
It gives me a lot of, it refreshes me to think that, yeah, I come from all this causes, but at the same time, I am planting the seeds right now to generate new causes, and I don't have to be that, you know, which that inertia of life has
yeah.
given me.
Right. you know, you can see that, but you have to be very careful, because there is this big eye, you know, the general eye that was in samsara that practices the path and that attains nirvana. There is that general eye. But you want to be very careful that you don't start thinking Rosio. Okay? Because then it's okay, Rosio's in samsara, this too. Now Rosio's dissolved into emptiness. Now Rosio is appearing as Chenrezig. You know, then there's still Rosio somewhere in there, you know? She snuck back in. She never left. So yeah, you want to get rid of that whole, you know, in when you're in the meditation of emptiness. All that appearance of the ordinary aggregates and the ordinary eye. And you want to go just to that general eye that is lightly labeled, merely labeled, independence on the aggregates.
And then also dependence on those aggregates.
Yeah.
But still we want to ourselves in the now.
Yeah. Not on your old aggregates. It's not that this body becomes the deity's body. No way.
Exactly.
Finished. This guy finished. Okay. This will be the last question because we have a self-existent lunch.
Yeah. Going back to the dog thing again.
Okay.
I'm still somewhat confused. You say it's valid in respect to the apprehended object.
Just the regular apprehension of the conventional eye is valid in relationship to the apprehended object. The grasping at true existence is not valid in relation to the apprehended object.
So when you're using apprehended object, the same as what Rinpoche was using as the mode of apprehension, object mode apprehension.
Yeah, he was using the expression mode of apprehension. He didn't say object of the mode of apprehension.
But what you're calling apprehended object is also object of the mode of apprehension.
Yeah, I'm just translating it as different.
So what is your apprehended object then for the valid?
The conventional eye.
So that means, I thought it's only when you... So that means we ordinary beings do have a split moment of apprehending conventional. I thought that was only when you realize.
You're apprehending the conventional eye, but not as conventional. Because it's still mixed in with the appearance of true existence.
But you have the appearance of true existence, but what are you apprehending?
You're apprehending the conventional eye. That we're talking about ordinary beings.
Right.
You're apprehending the conventional eye that is appearing as truly existent, but you're not grasping it as truly existent. So your mind is not, erroneous with respect to that object.
If you take away the grasping part, I mean, what is that object of apprehension, though?
That's the conventional one. That's the one that's merely labeled. That's unfindable.
Right.
But look for it.
Seems like at one point they also say that it's only after you realize emptiness.
Yeah.
That when you come out of meditation, that's when you can really apprehend the conventional eye. I mean, you're saying that.
No. There's a difference between. You can apprehend the conventional eye, but you can't apprehend it as conventional.
But what are you apprehending as?
You're just apprehending it. I'm apprehending the conventional pen. I can identify this as a pen. Okay? So my mind is not mistaken. The mode of apprehension or the apprehended object, however you translate, is the pen. I'm not mistaken with respect to identifying this as a pen, even though it's appearing as a truly existent pen to me. I'm still having a valid cognizer about it. If I start going, wow, this pen is like, then, you know, I start apprehending it as a truly existent one, and at that moment, that mind is erroneous with respect to the apprehended object.
So is it that when you apprehend as neither?
Yeah. Yeah. Before, when you're not grasping, it's as neither.
Neither truly exists, nor.
Nor, you're not apprehending it as conventional, and you're not apprehending it as truly existent. You're just apprehending it. Because Jay Rinpoche went to great pains to show that he wanted to establish that somehow us ordinary beings do have some valid cognizers. Yeah, even though they're mistaken, they're still valid. Because otherwise it would be kind of like destroying everything, you know, and saying everything could be called anything. But it's hard to understand because we can't differentiate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? We're talking about the neither part.
Yeah, the neither part.
Inherent or not?
Not inherent, yeah. Because we don't even know one from the other, so how can they neither? Yeah, it's just, yeah, the pen.
I mean, I see what color's well. It's not blue or yellow, but it could be red. You know, I mean, so it seems like it's not dark, it's not light. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It's not neither dark nor light.
Yeah.
You can say neither blue or green.
Yes.
Because there are other options.
Uh-huh.
And for me, that's one of the options between, like, non-inherent, existence, inherent
existence. Is it the appearance of inherent existence, but not grasping at it. Okay. Let's sit quietly for a few minutes. Oh, this has a bright red thing, so the battery might need to be changed again.